there and welcome. This is Conscious Living. I'm Wendy with my guest today, John D'Souza. And this is incredible, incredible. If you have read anything about the CIA files that, you know, they dumped about 2 million files out for everybody to peruse, the psychic spy stuff, among other things. The really good stuff is buried. 6 million files. Yeah, it's buried. So you're going to have to do some real stuff. Fortunately, John D'Souza can probably give it to us in a nutshell. Because for 20 years, he was one of those CIA, FBI, all sorts of paranormal, cool, behind-the-scenes stuff we never really get to hear about until now. So yeah, looking forward to hearing from you some of the stuff you got to work on that was classified until now.
Yes. Thank you, Wendy. That was my intro, I believe. So.
Yes, it is. It's your intro.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be with you here, Wendy, on Empower Radio. I really am looking forward. I was looking forward to this. Your audience is particularly awake and aware, and the type of people that would understand and be open to a lot of the ideas that I work with in my books. Like you said, I'm John D'Souza. I was an FBI special agent for over 20 years. During that time, I worked a lot of counterterrorism cases, violent crime cases, a lot of high profile cases. And at the same time, I also collected a lot of what I call the real X-Files, cases that had to do with the paranormal and supernatural elements that kept coming up over and over again in law enforcement cases, my own cases and those of many, many others. And that's what, you know, led me to write my first book once I retired from the FBI, The Para Investigators, which is the true tales and concepts of supernaturally gifted investigators.
What I wanted to get into real quick, I like the story in there. You were doing a lot of work that your fellow associates knew about. And at one point, you said the X-Man is actually a demotion from G-Man.
Yes. Yes. In the 90s, there was a show that your audience will recall, The X-Files on television. It was the show with FBI agents Scalder and Mully that dealt with a lot of paranormal cases.
And they're going to kick you for saying that wrong. You know that. Scully and Mulder.
Oh, it's Scully and Mulder.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. You know. Wow, you do know. You know your stuff. That's pretty good.
I watched the show. Give me a break. Yeah. You were accused of something, huh?
Yes. We had a minor little scandal there in the FBI. The higher-ups in the FBI, they came to the conclusion that there were some real cases and real facts going out on this show. And they wanted to know from the creator, Chris Carter. They actually called him up. Chris Carter talks about this today openly, that he was contacted by higher-ups in the FBI. And he was questioned as to who was giving him information about FBI procedures and some FBI cases. Because he was extremely accurate, apparently, in some of the episodes. Apparently, we're talking about things that actually happened in real life. So they contacted him, questioned him on that. Also, I was questioned about it because people knew that I was a great, great fanatic of the show. Mm-hmm. And I was able to truthfully say that I had no contact with the show. I was not a person who was giving them any sort of information. Then Chris Carter apparently said something. The creator of the X-Files show said something to the higher-ups that satisfied them. And he said he thought they were going to shut down the X-Files show. I don't know how they would have the ability to do that, but that's what he said. And they were satisfied with whatever he said. It's okay for FBI agents who are retired to consult with television shows and movies. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But people who are currently on board at the FBI are not allowed to do that. So that's where questioning of me came in. And like I said, I was able to say truthfully that I had nothing to do with talking to the show. But the nickname X-Man came from X-Files. I mean, it started out as X-File Man and went into X-Man. And I was told I was demoted from G-Man to X-Man after that.
For being the potential deep throat.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Okay, I want to get into this too, because the thing that you bring to the equation is the extra dimensional aspect. But I want to also go back into your background, because what I find fascinating and extremely helpful is that this wasn't an area that you were completely skeptical and totally uninformed about. You had an experience as a child that probably helped give you a lot more, I think, tangible ability to suspend your disbelief, because yeah. You were in up close and personal encounter with something that we don't know what really to identify it as, except unexplained.
Yes. When I was about nine years old, I was in New York City with my parents at a party. And we were a couple of hundred people. I'm getting some echo here suddenly. Couple of hundred people at a party in some rented hall in New York City about 1 a.m. Myself and a lot of little kids were at this party as well, and we wanted to get out. I was about nine. I was a bunch of little kids, probably ages from 9 to 12 to 14. And we all went out, spilled out into the night, and started playing tag. Very spirited game of tag out there. It was deserted. It was about 1 a.m, probably later than any of us had ever stayed up until that time. And we were out, spilled out into the street, playing out there. And one of the kids hit me in the stomach at some point. And I went down like a bag of rocks. And I was on the sidewalk on my back looking up, and one of the kids screamed, "Oh, he's really hurt." So they do what little kids do. They all ran away back to the hall. And so I was left there alone. I was under the stars there. Very starry night. Beautiful starry night. And I was looking up between two tallest buildings I'd ever seen up to that time in my life. And I was there was a giant black spot where there were no stars visible up between these tall buildings. Not between, but above. Just above the two tall buildings. And I kept looking at this one area trying to see through it, really. And I realized it was a black ink cloud, like the sort that a squid would give off in the water. And I just kept looking at it. And out of the bottom of this black, giant black ink cloud came what looked like a flying saucers. No other way to describe it, especially at that time. Just came out of, and with the spinning lights in the bottom, and just came down, started coming down towards me. And on my left appeared, I was on my feet by this time, looking straight up. And on my left, two teenage girls appeared, and they were screaming at the top of their lungs, screaming and crying and yelling at me, "Little boy, you better run home. Looks like the world might be ending." And then those two girls disappeared. And then I kept looking up. And this thing's coming down towards me. I felt like I was hit by a spotlight of some sort. And then at that moment, it's like myself and this flying saucer, this vehicle, we both changed our mind at the same moment. I took a step back, and the thing reversed course, started going back up again. Mm-hmm. And like a cartoon character jumps in the hole, pulls a hole in after it, this thing went right back up into that black cloud, and then the black cloud was gone. And that was it. I ran back to where my parents were, tried to explain to them what had just happened, and they were not happy to hear it in public. They told me to be quiet until later, and the results were the same at home anyway, so it wasn't really much difference. And that was it. But the cases I have looked, and of course, that experience, of course, led me to study and research these cases ever since then, even before I became an FBI agent. And one of the things I found is that these observation experiences happen to people, and then following that, there's often a follow-up where it's almost like the craft collects information on a person and then brings it back somewhere. And then alien visitors decide, okay, yeah, we'll visit this person. We'll have direct contact with them. And that's what happened to me. Short time after that, there was actually an alien visitor experience at my home. The age of nine, still actually just within a few weeks after that experience in my home, I was staying up late. I had a little bedroom that was just off of my parents' bedroom. And I was laying in bed at night and I was just thinking about the observation experience I had had previously.
Well, you also talked about how you were counting down the time because it was your big goal to make it to as late as you could simply stay up.
Stay up as late as I possibly could. I think I almost hit like 2 a.m. or even beyond that. And suddenly I just felt a cold vapor through the room. I went stiff as a board, and then I felt movement in the room. And I felt something lifting me up by my head and my feet. And it was lifting me like I was half filled, like I was a balloon half filled with helium. They were able to move me just like a piece of furniture, just very, very light furniture. And they were able to just move me and push me and pull me. And I couldn't move. I only had my peripheral. I couldn't see exactly who was carrying and moving me. But I was able to just see that they were diminutive. They were small, very slight, very small and very slight. That's about all I could really tell. And then they were moving me upwards towards the ceiling. And apparently they were able to move up with me as if they were climbing stairs, but there were no stairs there. It was like we were all kind of floating together, and they were able to pass through the ceiling themselves. I could see that they were passing through the ceiling as if it wasn't there, and they were trying to pull me through the ceiling as well. And something happened where my forehead wouldn't go through. And apparently this surprised them very much because they were perplexed. They kept lowering me a little bit. And again, wherever they lowered me in the air, I just stayed there a balloon just half filled with helium. I just would stay there. And they started examining the spot on the ceiling where I would not pass through, like the worst engineers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the worst engineers in the world. Uh-huh. They just because they kept trying to do the same thing over and over again with the same results.
They didn't think you were just hard-headed.
And they couldn't figure out what it was.
Yeah.
And they just kept on examining the spot and then trying again. And it kept on coming up with the same results. Well, as they were bumping my forehead at this, it gave me more flexibility, and I was moving my neck more and more. And I was able to, and the first thought that occurred to me was that maybe maybe I was dead, and this was some kind of spirit experience.
Yeah.
And so I craned my neck to look down at my bed to see if my body was there, I looked down and I was able to see that there was nothing there except rumpled sheets. So that I was relieved at that at least. And then I turned again over and I was able to see what appeared to me to be two diminutive gray figures with looked like they had rubberized sort of suits on, and they were smallish. They were great. And they were standing over because the door was open to my parents' bedroom, and I could see directly in there at this point. And there were two diminutive, grayish sort of figures that were holding their hands over my parents' bed. It looked like they were holding them asleep or in some kind of stasis field or something. And there was two of them, and they were very small, very slight. And I could see those large black eyes sort of almost wraparound sort of eyes. And as I looked and saw them directly, because I couldn't see the two that were carrying me, but I was able to see the two that were on the ground and that were holding their hands over my parents' bed. And my parents appeared to be sort of struggling, like they were trying to wake up, but they couldn't. And then one of them on the ground there looked directly at me. I looked directly at it. And I heard in my head, not through the ears, but in my head, I heard the only words I ever heard from these beings, which was the one on the ground just looked at me and said, "He's awake." And at that moment, I just slammed down into my bed. I became heavy like a bag of rocks again. I just slammed down. Springs are going crazy. And everything disappeared. Everything was gone. I mean, I just felt the entire apartment was empty. There was nobody there. And I sat up. I was trying to work up my courage. And I looked over at my parents, and they seemed okay now. They seemed at ease. They seemed like they were fine, but they still were asleep. And I was working up my courage to wake them up and talk to them, and just fell dead asleep at that time. And I didn't wake up until the morning, until the adults were shuffling all around. And apparently they had all had the shared dream of abduction. And they were all sitting around and trying to figure out what it was and how to respond. It was a big powwow. A big powwow was going on there between.
And your aunt was a little, she's like over the top quickly.
Yes. We had an aunt and an uncle who were living there. I think there was another adult there as well. And they were all very, very religious. And so they interpreted the whole experience. Again, they all had a shared dream of an abduction, an alien abduction. Well, they were getting their story together. It was almost like they were getting their story together for the neighborhood because they knew this was going to get out. It was like, that's the sort of thing it was. So I had an aunt who said, okay, this was a demonic invasion, that's what it was. And so they started tearing my dad's house apart, looking for what you call a guilty trinket. Something that had some kind of demonic sorceress influence on it, and that brought in these demonic influences into the home. Shortly after that, I think my dad, I'm very certain that my dad went out and bought some kind of Celtic rune charm and threw it under the linoleum somewhere so that it would be found and they would stop tearing his apartment apart. And so once they found it, you know, they did a big thing parading that thing around in front of me so that I would know they were right about everything, and that was it. Case solved, and everybody, and they, none of them believed me that this was actually an alien visitor experience, and they didn't want to hear anything about that.
Well, I think that would be frightening from their perspective. You know, that's not in any of their books.
Right. Oh, they were terrified. They were terrified, but they felt better once they had put it into their paradigm and executed their plan that could be used in their worldview. And then I think they felt better at that point.
Well, I think that to me, that gives you a much better perspective when you're dealing with these kind of X-file type cases, to say that maybe the people who are talking to you are telling you their truth.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And what it does is I believe it made me more objective as an investigator later, because I was open to other possibilities, not necessarily believing other possibilities, metaphysical possibilities always, but at least open to them. Whereas if you go to the other side and you have these people who have or investigators who only have a scientific worldview and nothing else, a scientific materialist sort of worldview, and they really have no ability to be, as I see it, they have no ability to be objective in dealing with paranormal phenomena because they can't see the other side. They can't be open to the other side. And that's really the truth. I mean, when a lot of these people say, okay, show me what proof you have. Show me how you can prove that this is true. What they're really saying is, how can you force me to believe? And that's a game that you can't win. You can't win that game. You can't force anyone to believe.
Well, I think somewhere in the book you also include the Einstein quote, which I really like. You can't solve the problem on the same plane that it's been created. You have to be somewhere outside of it, overview, in some way, shape, or form, not stuck linear looking at it face to face, because you're not going to get the full equation. And that's what's happening here, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Yeah, people have to be able to deal with situations where they are open to other possibilities that are not in the physical world, because when they're not, it can have tragic consequences. And that's one of the things that I show in my books to people, especially my first book, The Power Investigators. I show supernaturally gifted investigators who, because people were not able to examine them honestly and be open to their paranormal abilities, it would always come back to these sorts of situations where it's like burn the witch, you know, burn the witch. And that's what we need to avoid now. We need to be open to other possibilities so that we avoid those circumstances where people who are just helping and sometimes saving lives are not victimized by what they're doing, because people just can't believe how they're doing it.
Well, yeah, they don't. If I can't do it, then nobody else can either. So this is abnormal. And that's misguided. The book I had that you gave me was Extra Dimensionals, and you talk about the black swans in there. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. Black swans, you know, as most people know, there are things that are unthinkable to people. Unthinkable because they just cannot be, they just cannot be possible. But unthinkable just only means something that you haven't thought of yet. So if I tell someone, if I describe to someone what a black unicorn looks like, beautiful black mane, completely black eyes, and a horn of black ivory, and a very, very bad-tempered animal, and hooves that are amazingly also jet black. People would not have ever thought of a black unicorn ever before, but now that I said it, now that I described it to them, now they can actually think about that and see what that imagery brings forward in their mind. Same way with a lot of these issues in alien visitation. When, for instance, in 1961, when Betty and Barney Hill had the classic case of the abduction, alien visitor abduction, which happened along one of the highways in Massachusetts in 1961, it was unthinkable. It was something that no one had ever really thought of happening before, and they didn't understand how it could happen. But now we see that since 1961, in the modern era, since Betty and Barney Hill had their experience where they were stalked by a UFO in their vehicle was stopped. You know, all the electronics went off, everything stopped, and then they were acquired by these alien visitors and brought aboard a craft, and then they were subjected to the medical facility to all kinds of tissue extraction and blood sample, sperm, ova, everything being removed from them. Now, after that, we've had many, many more abduction scenarios like that, many more experiences. And I'm talking about the genuine ones, not the ones that we have actual evidence for, like we do for Betty and Barney Hill. Betty was able...
Yeah, it was forensic evidence with the dust that was in her dress. Kathleen Hart, and I've talked to her about this. And
yeah.
It was just a continual paranormal activity. Things changed from that point on. Yeah.
And not only that, talk about hard proof. Betty Hill was able to recreate a perfectly accurate star chart, star map, showing supposedly the alien visitors had shown her the star chart of where they supposedly came from. And it was something like 100 light years away from here. And she was able to recreate it perfectly. And our technology at 1961 was not able to duplicate what she did. But later, scientists were able, through satellites, to recreate and the fingerprint of the star chart that she had created actually came true and showed. And they were able to put the names of planets and systems and stars on that chart. Anyone can Google image search that, and they can find Betty Hill's star chart. And it's there. It's available. Anyone can see it. That's hard evidence of what happened to them. But even better evidence is the interviews that Betty and Barney Hill did that show absolute authenticity and truthfulness. If you want to see what truthfulness really looks like, just go see those interviews. They're in black and white, but they're still on YouTube. They're still up there. Anyone can see them. And that connection to human authenticity is the most valuable evidence that anyone can ever see.
We're going to take a break. I do want to get into some of that. I like that what you describe in the book, how you can tell the difference between someone who is basically dodging the truth, cartwheeling the truth, hiding from the truth, and somebody who's authentic. But we're talking with John D'Souza, X-Man, G-Man, FBI, retired man, and curiosity seeker.
You wanted to see me?
Yes, please, have a seat. So here's the thing. When this company brought you on, we took a chance on you. You didn't have that four-year college degree we typically look for.
Right.
But we gave you a shot anyway. And since then, you've worked incredibly hard and given it your all.
Thanks.
You've been an important asset to the team, but I don't think you can be an intern here anymore. We want to hire you.
You're serious?
Absolutely.
Find your next great employee. Introduce yourself to the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
I won't let you down.
I know.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
You don't usually get a stock tip from a 16-year-old, but I'm here to tell you about a different kind of stock. It's called Better Futures, a stock for social change that's not about making money. Instead, you invest to help students like me go to college. This is beyond a simple donation. It's the opportunity for America to invest in its kids and take an active stake in the future of the country. The return on your investment isn't money. What you get back is knowing you protected our potential. So one day, that potential can grow up to become surgeons and architects, executives and engineers, people who can change the future just by being a part of it. My name is Alicia, and I'm your dividend.
Invest in better futures with UNCF. Visit uncf.org/invest. A mind is a terrible thing to waste, but a wonderful thing to invest in. A public service announcement brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Me, a cat, moving in with a new human. It took a little getting used to. She has these weird games she likes to play, like this giant feather. She sticks it in my face. I swat it away. She sticks it in my face. I swat it away. It's almost like she thinks I enjoy it. But seeing how much fun she gets out of it, well, I guess it makes it all worth it. Humans.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
This is a guided meditation on parenting. Find a relaxed position to let go of the time you left your daughter's blouse in the dryer too long and it shrunk four sizes, or when you donated her private diary to the public library. Deep breaths.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
My guest, John D'Souza, has researched, and I wanted to get, before we get into the extra dimensionals and all that, is there one case that you worked on that stood out more than others that still you're scratching your head over?
I'll tell you one that I just have a really, really great curiosity over and affection for also is the case of Antonio Vicas Boas in 1957 in Brazil, of all places. Partly my own personal, my own heritage is from Brazil and Portugal. So it was always very interesting because I had my dad had always heard rumors about this situation because Antonio Vicas Boas was one of the most prominent and successful attorneys throughout his life in Brazil, and which was amazing because when he had his experience, he was just a field hand cutting down some crops. in the middle of the field. He was just a 23-year-old kid, and anyone who would have been seeing him work in the scythe and being out there in the fields would have just thought he was just a common peasant. But apparently he was a brilliant young man who just happened to be doing peasant work at that moment. And as he was doing that, he had a giant plasma ship just appeared over him. And then he had the plasma ship land, and he was taken aboard this particular ship. On that ship, he was encountered by what seemed like a beautiful young woman who was very light, very pale features. She was blondish, very thin sort of blondish hair. He said later she appeared sort of almost like some kind of hybrid. Although she was very, very beautiful young woman, she had features that didn't quite fit. Her eyes were slightly different, and her features were somewhat very smallish. But she was naked, and he was a very young man, and she made it very obvious that she wanted to have sex with him. He did more than once, several times. They did take some samples from him, and he was very happy with the experience that he had. And as he finished having sex with her, she couldn't talk. She was able to make sort of growling sounds, but once they were finished all the times that they were having sex, she pointed to her belly and made it clear to him that his job was to impregnate her, and she was going to have his child. Then they gave him a tour, some sort of tour of the vehicle that they had him on, and then he was returned right to where he had been. And one of the interesting things, one of the great coincidences of this case and all the other cases that are taken up by paranormal investigators of being real and authentic, is that after that, Antonio Vigis Boas, he lived a very long, productive life, and he was relentlessly attacked and challenged on the truth of his experience, which, unlike Betty and Barney Hill, he didn't really have any physical evidence of his experience that I know of, anyway.
Or a witness. But,
right, or witness. However, he was such a respected and prominent attorney who was so well known in Brazil that the fact that he maintained his testimony and maintained every single item, every single bit of the truth of everything that he said throughout his life until the day he died, it was taken by the community that every single thing, every word he said was absolutely true. And that's an amazing coincidence, because it coincides also with Betty and Barney Hill, who just a couple of years later, 1961, had another alien abduction experience, who maintained, again, in the face of great resistance and some attacks also, and maintained the absolute truth of everything, every detail of what they said till the day they died. Today we also have Travis Walton, who had in 1975, he had a major abduction experience, which turns out is a little different from what we thought it was. But he also, for 40 years, has maintained, and his witnesses, again, a lot of evidence, corroborating evidence in that case. But also, and here's one of the things I maintain in my book, The Extra Dimensionals, True Tales and Concepts of Alien Visitors. And what I maintain is that the most valuable kind of evidence, the most important type of evidence, is anything that can be connected to the authenticity of human beings. And that's what Travis Walton's case represents. That's what Betty and Barney Hill and Antonio Vigis Boas also as well. These cases represent absolute authenticity, because there has been enormous pressure. There are groups out there that make it their mission to try to tear down these cases, and they actually attack these witnesses, these people, and they do it consistently. And yet in these cases, the cases that we actually talk about, the small percentage that we see as being genuinely unexplainable and genuinely possibly extraterrestrial, these cases, they just have a tremendous amount of authenticity to them, and witnesses that never change a single detail of what they're saying is true.
It has to be a statistic. I hope I'm remembering it correctly. You said in the book about 94%, you can figure out some way to make that, there's some kind of a reason, but the other 6% is where these things are unexplained and they are authentic.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a great investigator, former NASA scientist, who is very well known in this area now. He basically wrote the book on Betty and Barney Hill and their experience, and he's the one who actually uncovered the cover up at Roswell.
Is that Stanton Friedman?
Yes, Stanton Friedman has a. That's very good. Thank you for the help. Stanton Friedman has a great saying that I like to quote. He says, and he says it to all these cynics who are constantly on the attack for these experiences. He says, so what if 95% of alien visitor experiences, observation experiences, and all the other experiences or UFO experiences are absolutely false or fraud or insufficient information to prove anything. So what? He said, that has nothing to do with me. He says, all I care about and the only thing that's relevant to me is the 5% or less of UFO cases that are genuinely unexplainable and possibly extraterrestrial. That's the only thing that's relevant to me, and that's all I care about. And I feel the same way. I think that's a great quote, and it's a great thing to always use to make people understand who will come up to you and will say to you, you know, how do you really believe that UFOs are real? Because they're talking about the 95%. They're not talking about the 5% or less that are genuinely unexplainable. And that's the only thing I deal with in my book, The Extra Dimensionals, and most reliable and credible investigators. These are the cases that we pay attention to. These are the ones that we look into and investigate very carefully.
Well, the ones I think that are really fascinating are the ones that, and I don't know why it's taken this long for people to really connect the dots and acknowledge that this is going on, the extra dimension, that trans-dimensional, that ultra-dimensional, something else is happening because they can manifest and then dematerialize. And there's nothing we can do about that, apparently.
Yes, exactly. You know, anyone can go on YouTube right now and look at the incident that happened in 2010. Googling the Dome of the Rock UFO, Dome of the Rock, which happened in Jerusalem. And there were lots of people that filmed it and got different angles of it when it happened. There was in 2010, I believe it's in January, there was a plasma vehicle that was just filled with light. And it was 1 a.m. in Jerusalem, Israel, Jerusalem. And this thing just came down. It just came down slowly from the sky and came down over the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. And it just settled right over the structure, sacred structure, called the Dome of the Rock, and it just settled there and hung there for a moment and then shot straight up, I mean, incredible speed. And it was captured by people who were on the ground filming each other, or sometimes by some CCTVs that were already set up, and it was captured from many angles. And what happens, though, is that there are, unfortunately, and I was with a group at that time that got a report from the ground in Israel, in Jerusalem, that this was happening. Well, immediately after it happened, they phoned in a report while it was happening. And they said to the person that I was with, they said, this is it. They're here. We're going to have disclosure. We're going to have revelation. It's all happening. And the person I was with said, no, it's not. It's not. He said by tomorrow morning, he said the original videos of this incident will be taken down and they will be replaced by fakes, and by fakes that have CGI breadcrumbs in them, because there are shops. And this is how he explained it to me. He was a person from another intelligence agency. Mm-hmm. And he explained to me that there are global shops that are set up to monitor any genuine paranormal incidences. And then they have the ability and the resources to create Hollywood level productions that are fakes, to copy the original incident, put it up and upload it, so that people who are rushing, like millions of people were rushing to see the Dome of the Rock UFO. And what happens is they took down the original, supposedly, and they upload these fakes that have CGI traces in them. And then everyone sees the fakes and they go, oh yeah, that's debunked. It's not real. And to this day, I don't know if the original, you can go there right now and see a dozen different copies of this incident. You can see it. It's still there.
I remember, but it's on Live Science right now. I remember when that happened, and Live Science says, according to their expert, that it's fake and this stuff is always fake. And, you know, why would anybody upload it to YouTube anonymously instead of submitting it to some expert somewhere? I can tell you, having taken my own, that's not the big deal. You don't think, oh, I'm going to go show this man the fence. Yes. Oh, I got a picture. Wow. The first thing you want to do is try and get validation from somebody else. And it really doesn't matter who. But the initial thing isn't how much money I'm going to make off of it. For the most people, it's like, what the heck? I've got to get my camera. I hope it works. And go from there. But so, you know, all this criticism afterwards, the armchair quarterbacking of fake, phony, is, I think, intentional.
Yes. And the science publications and mainstream media, that whatever little mainstream media that addressed this when it happened, they're doing their job. Their job is to avoid, at all costs, avoid any awakening event. They don't want any connection with any genuine supernatural event. And of course, they're going to say, oh, this is completely fake, you know, you guys. And not only that, they'll go further and they'll always say, you guys are idiots. Basically, they'll imply that. Anyone who even considers this, you know, you're the worst, you're the dumbest, and that's basically the tenor of everything.
It's shame.
Yeah, and it's too bad but again, they're just doing their job. There is no real scientific community that's going to examine this kind of thing openly with an open, objective mind. They're just not, because that's not their job. Their job is to get their grants. Their job is to give each other accolades and to do peer review for each other. And all of that would fall apart if they allow any paranormal reality or any non-scientific reality to bleed through into their paradigm. And they're not going to allow that. They're just not.
They're changing a little bit. Even the Pope recently basically called for more exorcists to be added to you because they're having an overwhelming number of things that they can't explain. And so Pope Francis is approving the need of more exorcists. And this information is from another source I've talked to. It's just the guy who wrote the St. Joseph.
Wow.
That this is something I looked into because apparently they authorized 2, and now there are 50 in the United States. But it's not because they think everybody is crazy, but because they think there are some things that are authentic and somebody needs to be helping these people rather than saying this doesn't exist, go away.
Yes. And if only we had that in ufology. You know, it's too bad that something like that can't be done for the UFO paradigm. But it does blend in with the extra dimensional hypothesis, which is the central theme of my book, which is basically that alien visitors, all the investigations that I've done and that I've looked at, they keep coming up with the same patterns and clues over and over again. And the final theme of my book, The Extra Dimensionals, is that it looks to me very likely that alien visitors are not physical. They are not like human beings. The way people want us to believe. They are not cramming themselves into little metal shells, sailing across the solar system, the galaxies, and visiting in these. They're not like humans that need craft. They are extra dimensional. And if anyone wants to know what I'm talking about, it's a very simple matter to go to this. Go to this website, FBI. FBI.gov, Vault, V-A-U-L-T, Vault.FBI.gov. Just go to that site, and then on the right side, this is the dumping ground for all of the declassified documents in the FBI, and they are all put out. Anyone can download them, can get them for free, and anyone can grab them. And you just go to, and on the right side, they have documents here in the hundreds and thousands on the JFK assassination, on cattle mutilations, on Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance.
The Kansas massacre.
Yes. any of these topics that you believe that the government doesn't want you to know about, they are now dumping so many, you know, thousands of documents on all of these topics, including UFOs. That's on there too. So if you go to this site, vault.fbi.gov, you just go there, and on the right side, you'll see unexplained phenomena. You click on that, and then on the left side, you'll see UFOs, and or UFO, just the word UFO. And then you click on that, and the first group of documents, number one, starts in 1947. You just click on that first group of documents, and then you go to page 22. On page 22, there is this document is called a memorandum of importance. It is dated July 8th, 1947. And it is shocking document written by an FBI supervisor. And it is probably more important. It's more important than the Guy Hotel memo, which a lot of people know about, mm-hmm. concerning Roswell. It actually says on it that he has a supernormal source, informant, a supernormal source that is giving him info about alien visitors, and that he must share this with the scientific community. So he's sending out this memo to the scientific community because he himself was a scientist before he became an FBI agent. And so before he joined the FBI. And so he's writing this memo, and he said, scientific community, and it says right there at the top of the document, and I call this document the smoking gun document.
Yeah.
But it's actually titled A Memorandum of Importance. And what it says is about seven or eight conclusions that were given to him by his source, who I believe had to be an alien visitor, because who else would know these things? He writes in there a lot of the conclusions that actually are, and I developed this, that I developed in my book. He says, number one, alien visitors are not physical. They are not coming here physically. Like I just said, they're not sailing across the galaxy in these little metal shells. They are actually trans-dimensional. They are extra-dimensional. They exist in other talas. That's an old Vedic term. They exist in other talas, realities that exist apart from us and that never intersect with our reality. They change their vibration to match our physical vibration in our universe, and that's how they come here. They materialize. And then for temporary periods of time, and then they dematerialize. He also says UFOs are empty. There's nobody in there. He says they operate on a sort of remote control, but they are empty. I also believe that UFOs are actually alive. That's the remote control that they are using. UFOs are actually alive, the real ones. Mm-hmm. And they're like golden retrievers. They come with the alien visitors. Yeah. And
those are the friendly ones, okay.
Yes. Well, but they carry out all kinds of duties for the alien visitors. They collect information.
It's better than a Rottweiler.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they can do hostile activity also. That mm-hmm. could be part of their functions, because I've seen cases again and again, like at the Rendlesham Forest,
yeah.
The American military base on British soil, where they invaded this military base and they were acting in a hostile manner towards the military base. They shut down an entire grid of supposedly nuclear weapons. Then they fired laser at the feet of some soldiers. They also sometimes went towards the soldiers and sometimes went away from the soldiers. And they were led them on a merry chase for an entire two nights in a row. And then they just kind of went away. But so these UFOs, they carry out many, many functions. Also in the, in that memorandum of importance, the one I just pointed out, anyone can find it. It's also, you will see there, he says that they are here for peaceful purposes, but they are trying to explore our universe to see if it's fit for them to inhabit permanently. And he also says that one of the conclusions is that if our Air Force ever attacks these UFOs, it would be a terrible, terrible thing. And we see that he's absolutely right, because we see in 1952, I believe, when Washington, D.C., the skies over Washington, D.C. were invaded by UFOs. And it was a recorded incident where the Air Force just couldn't deal with these UFOs that were running circles around them. And mm-hmm. that went on. And that went on for like almost a week and a half, I believe. Also, we see what happened. We see what happened at the Battle of Los Angeles.
Right.
When the entire, during World War II, the entire West Coast was militarized with anti-aircraft batteries. And then, of course, a couple of UFOs showed up over Los Angeles. And they cut loose with all these batteries of weapons and shot into the air. And apparently, the shells crashed into each other, created some explosions up there. But we see these automatic pictures that were taken, and anyone can look this up. There were pictures of the UFOs happily sailing away after all the batteries were shot at them, and sailing away with not a shot mark on them. Not a mark on them. Yeah.
Oh, you guys are so young. Hey, we're going to have to wrap up. But I do, we're going to talk again. You're going to join me on Wendy's Coffee House for the show at KCMO. And I'm also going to put some stuff on the blog. I've got Wendy's Coffee House blog. I did put a link already to the vault. That's also on the sideline of the blog. So the stuff in the vault, just a disclaimer, there might be some stuff that's sensitive and it's there. So it's fascinating to say that in there, and that you have background, personal background, knowledge of some of the events. At the same time, you go beyond that in your book and say, we really need to get prepared on a different level. And it has to do with things like out of body and dreaming and knowing what's going on in that metaphysical realm. And that's where we are behind the eight ball.
Yes.
So
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, these phenomena are not lessening. They're not tapering off. They're not leveling off. These phenomena are just getting greater and greater. And abduction phenomena, contact, observation phenomena, it's just increasing. We're approaching some kind of crescendo. And when that comes, it's probably going to be sooner rather than later. And we are not prepared. We don't have the understanding, the mind frame. We just don't have the understanding that we need. And sitting at the feet of government and begging Washington D.C. for disclosure, that's not gonna get anybody anywhere. It's not gonna help the situation, as far as I see.
They got better things to do than to tell us to upgrade our metaphysical awareness.
And just being in national government myself for such a long time, I just don't believe that they really know. I believe the national government, they follow orders. They follow orders even at the highest levels. And they're following orders from the EPIC, the elite powers in control at the global level. And that's what they do. They don't really have this inside knowledge that people ascribe to them. They just don't know. And if you go and you Google NASA cuts the live feed, if you want to see what I'm talking about, whenever NASA has a satellite up, thank God we have these computer nerds that are always recording everything so that we get the content. And it's always preserved. But if you Google NASA cuts the live feed, every time a satellite picks up an unknown UFO coming into view, just showing up out of nowhere, uh, they they are under orders to just cut the live feed. And they do it again and again and again. And I don't believe it's because they're part of some conspiracy or they're on the inside of some conspiracy. I believe they just don't know. They just don't know. They don't have control over who those UFOs are, what they're doing, or what their purpose is. And because they don't know, they don't want us to know. And that's why they cut the live feed. You can find over a dozen examples. If you Google what I said, you can find, and the video is out there. It's out there. They can't take it. They can't take it all down. So it's amazing stuff. But yeah, like I said, I believe that national government really doesn't know. They're not on the inside of this particular conspiracy, but they do follow orders, unfortunately. And they will always do that. That's where we are right now.
Thank you so much. We're going to get out of here.